traditions with us.
I'm a grateful alcoholic. My name is George.
Hey, George.
We are going to finish up tradition two and move on to tradition three. We're really on tradition three this week, but I want to make a correction. Somebody brought it to my attention last week. Somebody said I made the correction last week. I'm not sure. I talked about Bill's Lighting experience of being in 1945. It was actually in 1934. In case somebody didn't, if I didn't correct it then, let me do that now to start this. Part of the review of this second tradition, there's a couple of things. The long form of tradition two is shorter than the short form. The long form states that for our group purpose, there is one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. And that was prior to 1950. In 1950, the Alcoholic Foundation trustees were around, and they then turned around and changed the name to the Alcoholic Foundation into the General Service Board. Between 19 and 1955, that's when they came around. And there was a guy by the name of Bernard Smith, who was one of the guys who was on the one of the members of the trustees at the time, who was on the board and suggested to Bill, and it was Bernard Smith's suggestion that he add in that our leaders are but trusted servants. The reason for that was prior to that time, we were governed. We were governed by the foundation. They told us what we're allowed to do, what we're not allowed to do, and what went on. And once we got our third legacy and it was turned back to the membership, that came about so that Bernard Smith and Bill put in the short form, which is under the rules and which is one of probably the most deadliest piece of AA literature you can give to any member, and that's called the service manual. Because the service manual talks about three things. It talks about what alcohol will do to you, talks about rotation, and it talks about death. It tells you what we do, and that's what it talks about. And it tells us how we carry that message outside of here. So we get to that second tradition, and we talk about what is group conscience. There's a great little pamphlet that I love, and this is one of my favorite pamphlets. It talks about the second tradition, and it's like a coloring book, in case anybody hasn't seen it. And in the beginning of it, it tells us that I've been elected secretary. I'll show this group some real leadership. There's only one way to do it, and that's my way. And then it goes on, and furthermore, we'll take the money and establish it and manage it. Same guy. And then eventually the group conscience comes over the group and tells the group, tells the individual, down boy. Pretty much that's what it says, down boy. Thank you, we shall talk to you about working the program. And working the program is that the minority opinion in this meeting right now is just as important as the majority. The minority voice means a lot here. And we listen to it very carefully because the guy who is always right and that we don't want to listen to, maybe we should, because this time he may just be right. And the minority person who doesn't say much carries just as much weight. And that's that thing that we're all equal when we walk in here. So that's real important. And then you have the elections that go on, and you've got a group secretary, and the group rep, you've got a general service, a conference delegate. And you got to remember one thing about every one of these people. Every one of them, they serve for the good of all without authority over any one of us. They have no authority over us. No trusted servant or no elected official of any group has any authority over any member. And that's real important. That's leading us into this membership thing that we're going to be talking about. So it starts with there are no barriers and there are no rules. And you walk into here, if there's no barriers and no setups for any kinds of rules or regulation and there are no rules, who runs this thing? Well, if you think back to your very first meeting that you ever walked into, the feeling that you had when you heard the people in the room, that was a group conscience. And that's pretty much where you first feel that group conscience working, was probably at your first meeting. At least that's where I felt that there was the hope, there was the smiles, there was the laughter. It was something that attracted me to that. All we do in here is we open the door more wide for anybody else coming down the road. In the old days, they were looking for this mythical person called the pure alcoholic. And we'll talk about the first 10 years and all about all that. The mythical alcoholic, the pure alcoholic, the big book, there's another part that calls it the true alcoholic. For the first 10 years, there were all kinds of rules and regulations that went on. And we'll get into that in tradition three. Publicity started to bring odd types of people in. We had publicity at the beginning. So the publicity came first from the Post article, and then there was blurbs in the paper, and more people were infiltrating. There was a lot of odd types of people. Let's talk about the odd types of people that AA didn't want any of. The odd types were criminals. They were social deviants. We got at that now. You had degenerates, you had women, you had gays, and you had black. And we didn't want them in AA when we first started. Through group experience, we started to bring down those membership rules. We'll get into that in three. There was all these other complications that came in with this. This was nothing but fear. We lived in fear at the beginning because the people that were here that started carrying the message, they were building on a premise that we reach out to any other person that's an alcoholic. They were trying to actually make people alcoholics so they could bring them into membership. And that wasn't working real well. And that's, you know, the women weren't getting sober at the beginning, and there's a couple of women we talked about over the first couple of weeks that got sober and stayed sober and helped many, many women. And we're going to talk about a few stories in the third tradition. There's a couple of really good stories in the third tradition. All right, we do not know who will show up in AA. Ever since AA got started, every type of person has showed up, and we wouldn't be, we'd be very dull if they wouldn't have all these colorful personalities. I mean, who would want to come here if we were all the same? So that, you know, finishes up pretty much of where we end up on the second tradition. There's a bunch of questions I've been reading on a weekly basis when we finish a tradition. And in tradition two, there's some questions you can ask yourself, how well you're practicing this tradition. And I want to leave it kind of open because tradition two really leads right into tradition three. As each tradition does, as like each step does, they kind of lead into each other. And here is tradition two. For our group purpose, there is one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. All leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. Here's the questions you can ask yourself about relationships or how you relate to the group or how you relate to others. Do I criticize or do I trust and support my group offices, AA committees, and office workers, newcomers and old-timers? Am I absolutely trustworthy, even in secret, with AA 12-step jobs or other AA responsibilities? Do I look for credit in my AA jobs, praise for my AA ideas? Do I have to save face in group discussion, or can I yield in good spirit to the group conscience and work cheerfully along with it? Probably one of the hardest things we got to do in here. Although I have been sober for many years, am I willing to serve my turn on AA chores? In group discussions, do I sound off about matters which I have no experience and little knowledge? Now, those are some things to not only carry into your group, but carry it into any relationship. If you ask yourself these questions, you'll see where you really stand with yourself and with others. All right, and we get to the third tradition. And in the third tradition, there's a lot of stuff that I like. I mean, I personally like. I want to tell a couple of stories. I want to start with the first story of Bill in 1940. In 1940, Bill went up to a place and met two black men who were in an institution, and it was a higher education institution. And he came out of this institution, and they asked if they can come to AA, and he said, absolutely. Now, you've got to remember the time it was. And what ended up happening in the third tradition, and the third tradition, let me go back for a minute before I tell the stories. The third tradition is three ways you hear it. In the very first preface, it says an honest desire to stop drinking is the only requirement for membership. The long form, and before they changed it again, and in AA Comes of Age, it says a sincere desire to stop drinking, and what we have in the form that we use is a desire to stop drinking. And I'm glad they took out honest and sincere, because I was neither of those when I got here, and I don't think any of us are. I think it's something we learn as we stay here. I didn't even want to be here when I got here, and I'm going to tell some stories about me, because the third tradition is what saved my life, literally getting here. AA membership. The first A stands for alcoholic. And I had a lot of problem with that because I didn't believe I was one of those. Publicity started to bring us in all these odd types that we talked about, the criminal and all those other kind of people that we didn't want, the gays, the blacks, the women. We were really fighting that. We were a secret society when we first started. It was you had to know somebody that brought you in and that took you through the fellowship. And there's lots of stories. Some guys say, you know, the old way they used to do the steps is, did you have enough? Do you believe in a power greater than yourself? Get on your knees. Let's write a fourth step. And that's one way I heard it was done. If you listen to some of the other stories, Dr. Bob took somebody up into his bedroom. They got on their knees and said the third step prayer together. Different things you hear. I don't know what really held water, but there is some good history that does hold water. And I was starting to talk about these two guys. There was two guys that came in the early 40. He invited two black members to attend in AA meetings in the New York area. After hearing him speak at an institution, they asked whether on their release they might join AA. Bill said yes, and a few weeks later they appeared at the meeting. I remember well because I was there, and that was Bobby B. Immediately, a reaction started up within the group. We had some Southerners who would strongly felt that Bill overstepped making this decision before consulting the group. They were readily to secede from AA and walk out. The other hand, there were some Northerners who thought Negroes, and that's the old wording, not blacks, should come in full members with full privileges. And of course, there were those who were sitting on the fence. First big issue was over race. And we're talking about the early days. And and Bill had a great sense of timing, because what person in 1940 could go down south into the middle of Alabama and say, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and expect to live through the meeting? It wasn't going to happen. There was a lot of bigotry going on. It was very hard. And if you read, and we talked about Jim Story, who was one of the first black members that came in, who became a lawyer, who ended up writing this story, and his story is in the book, Jim Story, and he was the first black man that came into AA, and he started the first black AA group. So there was a reason for that. Bill realized immediately that we made a mistake, so he asked those who objected if they would agree that Negroes had a right to AA just the same as any other human being, continued Bobby. On the basic principle, there was complete agreement. So it was more or less decided that Negroes should be invited to an open or closed meetings as visitors. And that's how they started getting into AA. Same thing with the women. The women were, we talked the story about of Florence, who was the first woman who went out and committed suicide. We talked about last week in the other tradition about Gladys, who beat Ebbie Thatcher to get into an AA meeting. So women started coming in, and how they started helping other women. And now it's about 50-50. So about 45-65 the membership. So that was one of the stories. The other story that I like was Dr. Bob. You know, when you read there's three stories in the 12 and 12. One of the stories is Jimmy Burrell, they call him Ed in there, who we talked about, the car polish salesman who was an agnostic. He was at an early meeting, they put him up to speak, and it was his turn to speak, and he got up there and he started going off on the no God issue. And they really prayed that he'd go out and get drunk. He stayed sober for a long time and helped a lot of people. And what ended up happening with Jimmy Burrell, he is a very good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He died a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He helped many, many people. But he did go out and get drunk. While after he had to speak, and they led him out to the door, and they grabbed him after the meeting, and they said, listen, you can't talk that way in AA. He says, well, either you're going to believe what you guys wrote or you're not. It says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And that was really important. And they asked, do you mean it or not? And they said, yes, they did. He had AA over a barrel, and he stayed. And then he went out and got drunk, and nobody went to help him. They let him stay wherever he was drunk. He found a Gideon's Bible, so the story goes. He came back to AA 2 weeks later and stayed sober ever since then, and then started talking about God. The other agnostic was Hank Parkhurst, who used to sit with Bill. And when somebody come in the room, they would judge whether they had enough of a bottom to come into Alcoholics Anonymous or not. They'd tell them to go out and continue drinking because they weren't low enough. That was the way we were when we were being born, actually, in our early years. Then there's the story of Dr. Bob in that same 12 and 12. And there's another story. And I'm going to tell the story of Dr. Bob. There was a cross-dresser that walked into Akron, Ohio. Now, these two stories are locked in together, and we confuse them as one story. They're two different incidents in two different places. One was in Akron, one was in New York. The one in Akron was about a guy who was a cross-dresser, who was gay. He walked in to Akron, and there was two guys in the room, and he said he wanted to get sober, and he said, you know, he had another problem, which is more devastating than alcohol. And they turned around and they said, okay, they got a hold of Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob came down, and the three of them spoke about this guy, and Dr. Bob came up with this thing, what would the master do? And they let him into AA. He stayed, I don't know how long he stayed, but that's only one of the stories, and nobody ever asked Bob again whether somebody should walk in the door or not walk in the door. Then there's the other story, a friend who they called It for a long time, and he has a name. I'm going to tell his story tonight because I went digging through a lot of good archive stuff. There's a guy named David Aronoff, who is no longer with us, who was a Texas archivist, and he had lots of great information, and he was around for this guy. He was dropped off, this thing, and that's the way they describe him, this thing was dropped off by two cops at the 23rd Street Clubhouse on 24th Street, typical alcoholics that we are. And he was dropped off. He walked in. He had a dress, had a pocketbook. He had a blonde wig. He was a dope shooter. He was a pill taker. And they dropped him off at AA. And there was a guy by the name of Barry L. And Barry L. was at the desk at the clubhouse. And he said, what do you want to do about stopping drinking? Anyway, he told him that, you know, he wanted to stop drinking. He didn't know how he got there, so he went and sent him into the back with the other guys, and two of the other guys threw him out, literally threw him out of the clubhouse, out back onto the street. Barry didn't know what to do, so he called Bill. Bill came down, stepped over the guy, walked into the thing, and asked Barry what was going on, and he told him he was a dope shooter, he was this, he was that. He said, well, did you ask him what he wanted to do about his alcoholism? And he said, yes. He said he wanted to stop drinking. He says, okay, that's all we need to know. We don't need to know anything else. So he went back outside, he went over to this guy, and he says, you come with me. And he walked him into the back room, and he told the guys in the back room, where they were playing dominoes or cards, that's always another one of those contradictions. He says to them, I want you to meet the newest member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You need him as much as he needs you. And that man stayed. That man, now you got the appearance. Now, his name was Harold. Harold got sober in 1944. He stayed sober till 1984 when he died. Harold was not gay. He was not a cross-dresser, and he, you know, when you find out Harold's story, Harold ended up, he was a dancer in vaudeville who was a tap dancer, and he joined the chorus line up there, so he was dressed for the occasion, and he was walking around Broadway, and the cops were worried to death that something was going to happen to him. So they brought him in to the 23rd Street Clubhouse, hoping he can get the help. Well, what ended up happening was he stayed. Not only did he stay, he became a very good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was such a good member that he had sponsees that had sponsees that had sponsees. Can you imagine what would have happened had we kept him out? That's something to think about. And that's why Harold is such an important part of this, putting this little piece of history together. So, and like I said, who are we to judge anybody who belongs here who don't? Now, you know, you can talk about the guys who have earrings in their ears, tattoos, pink hair, orange hair, yellow hair, green hair, I don't care what they look like, or the girls, how they dress, or what they do. It really doesn't matter what you did, what you do, or what you're going to do. As long as you have a desire to be in this room, you are entitled to be in this room. And that brings me to my story. When I got here, I came in as someone who was dropped off in Alcoholics Anonymous because I was coming from a halfway house, and that's where they dropped me off. Now, I didn't think I had an alcohol problem. Alcohol was my solution, and in my story I talk about that. But there was a third tradition, and I used to beat the third tradition, and I used to beat the first tradition. Because when I came in here, they let me do whatever I needed to do. They loved me enough to let me be myself right where I was. As a matter of fact, there's somebody in this room who was with me from the very beginning who can tell you what a wild man I was when I got here. And I had no respect for the room I was in. I didn't care about what went on. I didn't care who I stepped on. I was so argumentative and so disagreeable, but there was something in here that kept me coming back. I used to come in and use the third tradition. I have a desire to stop drinking, and then I would talk to you about a crack pipe, about pills, about anything else but alcohol. And I learned about respect to the rooms. And we talked about Harold. There's a part in a little pamphlet we have, Other Problems Besides Alcohol. And in it, there's a great line, and the line is that although he had more than one problem, his alcohol and needle use was taken care of through Alcoholics Anonymous. So when I was shown that pamphlet, it didn't matter what the other things were. I had to come in here with respect to that first tradition and that third tradition and express that I had a desire not to drink and to stay on subject. That was really hard for me. So however we get here in tradition three really doesn't matter. If you get dropped off by a halfway house, if you're sent here by the police, if you think you're strange in the way you're dressed or the way your attitudes are, it's okay. Because what ends up happening is if we don't judge anybody that walks in the door, we don't know what kind of member that person is going to be for Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's really something very powerful, because if it wasn't for the love of the people and there was no requirement, now why was there no requirements? That's the question. The reason, and there's a whole bunch of it, the third tradition is a sweeping statement indeed. It takes out a lot of territory. Some might think it is too idealistic to be practical. It tells every alcoholic in the world that he may become and remain a member of Alcoholics Anonymous so long as he says so. In short, Alcoholics Anonymous has no membership rules. Why is this so? Our answer is simple and practical. Even self-protection, we do not wish to erect the slightest barrier between ourselves and the fellow alcoholic who still suffers. We know that society has been demanding that he conform to its laws and convictions, but the essence of his alcoholic malady is the fact that he has been unable or unwilling to conform either to the laws of God or man. If anything, he's a sick alcoholic, is rebellious and a nonconformist. Now, if you want to know what I was rebellious and a nonconformist. I don't think any of us walked in here one day and said, hey, listen, I'm in such a good mood, let me go to AA and give him my spiritual well-being. I came in here because I was broken and I was hurt and I didn't know how to live. Well, we understand that. Every member of Alcoholics Anonymous was once a rebel himself. Hence, we cannot offer to meet him in any halfway mark. We must enter the dark cave where he is and show him that we understand. We realize that he is altogether too weak and too confused to jump hurdles. If we raise obstacles, he might stay away and perish. He might be denied his priceless opportunity. You know, one of the things I got when I got in here was about language. I had a sponsor that said, it's very offensive. I didn't understand that because that's how I spoke. There's a lot of people who can do it, and it's okay if that's what you do. I just don't do that anymore. I did that. And my sponsor made it very clear to me when I was pretty new in recovery. He says, you know, you have a mouth like that, and you talk about these other substances that you do in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and there's this old lady who comes in for the first time who maybe drank a little bit too much wine one day and realized her life was unmanageable, and she had a bottom way up here, and you had one way down here, but you both came in with zero. And what you can do is you can have an opinion on what you think Alcoholics Anonymous is and what it isn't, and tell your story, and she never did a drug, and she doesn't feel she belongs, and she goes out and drinks and dies. You have that power to kill. So be careful what you say in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. That was a great lesson in learning the first tradition and knowing there's a loving God that leads me to that third tradition. If I am up here giving all different things besides alcohol, I'm diluting our singleness of purpose, which will come on in another tradition, which will hurt our membership, which will kill our unity, which will get us drunk. Not just me, us. So we keep a singleness of purpose for a reason. That's why there is over 200 and some odd other 12-step programs today. We had them first, we passed them on, we give them away. Anybody that wants them can use them, they can modify them any way they want, but this is Alcoholics Anonymous. So that was real important to me for to learn in the third tradition. So we ask if there are any conditions. We joyfully reply, no, not one. When skeptically comes back saying, but certainly there must be things that I have to do or believe, we quickly answer, in Alcoholics Anonymous, there are no musts. There are a lot of your orders or your shoulds, but there are no musts. Then it tells us the reality of Alcoholics Anonymous bursts upon him. For Alcoholics Anonymous is saying, we have something priceless to give if you only will receive. That is all. But our new friend, it is everything. Without more ado, he becomes one of us. I did not come into Alcoholics Anonymous to get sober. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous to get my kids back and deal with my ex-wife. That's what I came in for. I did not come in here because I wanted what you guys had. I didn't like any of you when I got here. really didn't like a lot of people when I got here. And I'm sure they didn't like me. That was okay. I liked when people didn't like me because that gave me another excuse or another reservation, as my sponsor would say, to go out and get drunk again. So I came in here looking for every reason in the world not to be an alcoholic. And in our book, it tells us in How It Works, if you're willing to go to any length, then you're ready to take certain steps. Until I was willing to let go of my old ideas and trust in a process I didn't think was going to work for me, which meant the traditions were already infiltrating my life through the through the steps. Those principles were coming into my life because I wanted to be one of you now more than I didn't want to be one of you. And I didn't know how to get away from that defiant, rebellious individual and say, I need help. That's where it all starts. I need help. And when I said I needed help, I got the help. The people loved me enough to let me be who I was, where I was, till I can grow and to be what they started to teach me, to be a better person and a better human being. So in the end of 44, the membership has been growing. We're growing. I mean, we're talking now, it's now the year 2010. We went from a couple of thousand members to millions now. And the membership is still growing. And there are all kinds of strange types that come in here. That's why we have so many different types of meetings, for all the different types, because we have such colorful personalities that most of us would not get along. So we each find our own place in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the only requirement, and nobody can throw me out of here, I'm a member when I say I am. Isn't that a great thing? So I used to say I was a member and I'd start chaos. That's one of the good things about being an alcoholic. And you know what? And what ends up happening is those bleeding deacons that tell you you're going to get drunk, they don't know that. They're not smart enough to know that. And there are other people that say, you know, let him be, he'll turn out okay, God will take over. Usually what happens, there are three authorities, I say. Well, there's two authorities, a loving God, that you either decide to do what he says or you go out and drink. And then there's alcohol, who says if you don't do what God wants, you're going to get drunk. So what ends up happening is that you turn around and you start conforming, first because you have to, then because you want to. And in the third tradition, all you have to do is walk in here and not know if you belong, but be willing to keep coming, because if you stay long enough, you will find what a desire means. Everybody's desire is measured differently. You can have a little desire, you can have a lot of desire. You can have no outside problems when you get in here, you can have a world of outside problems. You can have no ex-wife or children or police or other problems, or you can have a whole load of stuff going on. Doesn't matter. Once you walk in here, you're as equal to the most sober person in this room. And that's one of the greatest things about membership, that there is only one requirement, a desire. Now, everybody's got to measure their own desire and what they want. I came in here not wanting to be here. The desire came into me through people like you, who loved me enough to show me that there was a better way. Tradition 3 in the long form talks about a sincere desire. In the original, it said an honest desire. If they had that in there when I got here, I was so confused and I was thought I was so right that it made no difference what anybody was telling me because I couldn't hear them anyway. I could have never have stayed. What they did is they opened the door for me wide enough to let me be who I was, where I was, and I think one of the greatest sayings in the third tradition is live and let live. That tradition carries over to meetings, though. When somebody gets up in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and starts talking about other substances in detail, that's not Alcoholics Anonymous anymore. And it's a chairman's responsibility or someone in the group to talk to them nicely the first time and then shut them down the second time, because we are responsible to keep the single message going that it's an alcoholic helping another. If there's other issues, there are other solutions. And you can stay in Alcoholics Anonymous with all those other issues and still be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous, as long as you focus when you're in here on the alcohol. And that is a hard thing for us to do, because it's my ex-wife, it's my codependency issues, it's my drug issues, it's my legal issues. That's not what we're here for. We're here for one purpose and one purpose only, a desire to stop drinking. And as long as you have a desire to stop drinking, you're welcome to be in this meeting. I didn't feel welcome when I got here. You guys opened up a door and made it wide enough and loved me enough that you made me want to come back. So I'm going to quiet down on tradition 3 for this week. We'll recap it next week and go to 4. Thanks for letting me share.